Welcome to the Property Funder podcast. I'm here today with Ray. And before we start talking to Ray, first of all, for those of you who are returning listeners or viewers, thank you very much for your support. Really means a lot. If I could have one thing that I ask you to do is give us a five-star review wherever you consume your podcast, whether that's Google, YouTube, Apple Music or Spotify, that really appreciate that because it means that we can speak to more inspiring and interesting people like Ray, and we can certainly get more people consuming the content as well and have these inspiring and uplifting messages from these accomplished entrepreneurs that we speak to go to more people. The next bit of housekeeping I want to do is I want to thank the show sponsor, Avonmore Capital. Avonmore Capital is a development and bridging lender based in London, but lending all over England and Wales on projects from £250,000 now up to £25 million with a recent bridge product launch. So go to www.avonmorecapital.com or you can reach out to me. I'm actually one of Avonmore's co-founders. Now, without further ado, let's talk to Ray. Now, Ray, could you tell us your full name and tell us the business that you are now part of?
Good morning. My name is Ray Palmer, Raymond John Stewart Palmer, and I'm chairman of Fiera Real Estate, which used to be called Palmer Capital. Palmer Capital was sold about 4 years ago, and subsequently the name changed to Fiera, which is a Canadian quoted fund manager.
And you've been in the property industry for a long time, highly respected. You've been feted by the Props Luncheon Awards, which is a cause very close to my heart. So you're obviously highly respected, highly accomplished person in the world of real estate. Can you take us back to your early days? How did you get into the real estate industry? What was it that led you to start in the real estate industry? And then maybe let's talk through how we kind of got to Palmer Capital and Fiera thereon.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Flattery is always a good thing. My parents didn't do well financially, and I left school at 16. My headmaster had advised that I should become an engineer because I was always very good at maths, but actually I didn't fancy that and went to work for a local estate agent in Essex. At 16, unfortunately, the principal sales negotiator, some 12 months later, had a car accident. And I became the principal negotiator. So his ill fortune was my good fortune, if you like. And it turned out that I was quite good at selling things. However, by the time I was just past my 18th birthday, I discovered that I was actually earning more than the office manager because I was on commission. And I thought, hang on, there's no real future here, if that's all it is. I'd done a bit of research and discovered that commercial estate agents were the top of the tree. So my selection process was a little crude in those days, because I'm very old. They still had Mayfair telephone numbers. So I approached everyone with a Mayfair telephone number. And eventually got a job with what was called Edward Erdman, which was one of the big practices of those days. I stayed there 10 months. After 5 months, I gave in my notice as I was offered a job to go and work for Elliot Bernard at Michael Laurie. Edward Erdman persuaded me to stay, largely by doubling my salary. 10 months later, I gave in my notice again and went to work for Allsops in Soho Square. Allsops was a great place. I went, I was then 19, I went into the shops department at Allsops. Interestingly, after few months, I sent a memo to the senior partner of Allsops explaining how the department was run terribly. And a few weeks later, the six-man department was quite shocked to discover that their junior of 19 was now the manager of the department. I then stayed about another 12 months or so at Allsops, and I then joined Robin Smith and John Lambert, who had formed Lambert Smith and Partners at that stage. They had both been at Edward Erdman, and I knew them from then. I didn't manage to persuade them to change the name, but the negotiation was equity or name, and I ended up with a substantial amount of the equity, which seemed a better deal to me than the name. And so I became an equity partner in Lambert Smith and Partners. At age 21, I virtually immediately became both the managing partner was no big deal, there was only three of us and three secretaries, and the largest fee earner. And I continued in that role until we sold the business in the late 80s. There was a phase of sales of surveyors, and we sold the business to a company called Abaco, who were quoted at the time. Subsequently, they were taken over by British and Commonwealth, who in turn went spectacularly bust. By the time British and Commonwealth went bust, we had acquired a number of other businesses, and the business had been renamed Lambert Smith Hampton. I've been responsible for negotiating those various acquisitions, and we bought the business back from the receiver of British and Commonwealth at a tiny fraction of what we'd sold it for in the first place. I then stayed with Lambert Smith Hampton about another 18 months, but I realized that during the latter period at Lambert Smith Hampton, I'd largely been buying businesses or selling Lambert Smith and Partners in the first place. So I hadn't actually been a surveyor for some years, and I'd been acting as a principal. So having passed go a couple of times, I sold out of my shares in Lambert Smith Hampton and formed Palmer Capital. I did incidentally subsequently buy back into Lambert Smith Hampton whilst it was a quoted business, and sold out again. So I managed to sell out of Lambert Smith Hampton three times. And I set out to be an investor developer. What I actually discovered, I'd made a few million, but not a huge amount of money in property terms. But having made a little bit of money, I was a bit too cautious as a buyer of deals of whatever form. And I was coming second, third, or fourth when I was bidding for something, which is no good at all. You either win it or you don't. I was, because I'd made a little bit of money, I was hanging on to it a bit too tightly. I did one or two deals, including one very good one in Leeds, but actually I wasn't doing enough deals to keep myself busy. At that stage, there was an advertisement in the Estates Gazette as to where properties used to be sold for some people looking for financial backing. That was the people that formed Renbridge. And what they wanted was financial backing and a grey-haired thinker. I had far less grey hairs than I do now. And I was 45, so my definition of grey-haired thinking has changed a bit since. But they wanted financial backing and grey haired thinking. So I became a very active non-executive chairman, and I owned a third, and the other two guys in Renbridge owned a third each. And that formula worked really well. And Renbridge made a profit in its first year. We're still invested in Renbridge, it's still one of our best businesses, and it's made a profit every year since. And I thought, hang on, this is quite a good formula, because the two guys running Renbridge were really enthusiastic in their early 30s. So they were encouraging me to be much more bullish than I would otherwise have been. Conversely, I was asking all the what if questions, what happens if this goes wrong, da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. And the combination caused them to be a little bit more cautious, caused us to de-risk deals appropriately, and caused me to be a little bit more bullish. And that became the template for every property company that Palmer Capital backed since. So, it was Renbridge, and then gradually we followed with further investments, always taking the same shareholding, so we didn't have a conflict preferring a deal because we had more shares in one rather than the other. And then about 10 years later, our venture capital business was going very well, and we had been doing deal after deal after deal with the same institutions in terms of funding those deals. But every transaction was a one-off negotiation. And in 2004, we launched the Palmer Capital Development Fund, which was the first fund that Palmer Capital launched. It was the first ever discretionary development management fund. And many of our investors are still invested in the Palmer Capital Development Fund series of funds. So what we found was that on the one hand, we had a portfolio of property companies. So we had property companies finding deals, wanting money. And on the other hand, we had institutional investors wanting enhanced returns. The two went brilliantly together.
And so you had this nice combination, really nice combination of venture capital and, I suppose, fund and a fund management business effectively, exactly, that went alongside each other. How did that then play through the noughties and then into the teens as well?
Well, immodestly, it played very well. The problems that we had in the various crashes through those periods, we actually never as a business lost money. Sometimes we didn't make as much as we had been in previous years, but we never lost money because we still had the focus that I started with of being a little bit cautious about wanting to de-risk. And that continues to this day. I was last week looking around a development that we've just finished at Anstey, which is near Coventry, which is a scheme of approximately 900,000 square feet industrial, which we forward sold with vacant possession. And that element of de-risking has continued through our funds. Development is all about buying a site, letting it, and selling the resultant investment, but not necessarily in that order, as the saying goes.
It's interesting you talk about development in that way. As someone who kind of wears both the lender and the developer and the investor hats, so maybe three hats if you really want to go down that road, did you ever consider that instead of selling developments, actually holding onto them and retaining the income a sitting on the income stream, or did it just, was that never really a logical way of running the business or business models?
It is a logical way of running the business, and as it happens, we are contemplating that at the moment. But you've got two different types of risks. If you buy a site with or without planning consent, you've got planning risk, you've got construction risk, and then you've got letting risk. And the investor that wants the enhanced return that gives them very often an IRR in the high teens and equally often an IRR in the 20s is not the same style of investor that wants a nice building let to a decent tenant on a long lease. Mm. The risk profile of those two different types of investors is quite tricky. Also, we are a venture capital investor in the development companies that we've got, and the development companies want their reward on completion of the development. So there has to be a capitalization moment, which is quite tricky in the circumstances, because as a purchaser of property, you always want to buy it as well as you possibly can. And as a vendor of the property, you always want to sell it as well as you possibly can. And if you're both, there's a hell of a lot of conflicts of interest to manage. So it's normally best to keep those functions apart.
Keep it clean, essentially.
Yes.
Keep it clean, keep them distinct. It's really interesting you talk about when you left LSH and you set up Palmer Capital, and you said that you were too cautious. What age were you at the time? Because I imagine it's not too far, too different to where I am now, actually.
I was in my early 40s.
Yeah, so almost identical, yeah.
And it was, as I said, I managed to pass go a couple of times or so with Lambert Smith Hampton. And I had children. You do get cautious. Money either makes you more ambitious or it balances you and you try to hang on to what you've already made. And I'm in that latter camp.
Yeah, because the reason I find it fascinating is I find myself in that position where I certainly have been, where I've had to, in a way, force myself to have more risk appetite as an investor over the last at least couple of years. I think that having gone through the last 15 years or so, let's say 12, 13 years, actually being more accurate. And actually someone reminded me of this yesterday. I remember being in my early 30s, only having one child who was very young, you know, living, you know, effectively living next to family or living with family, very few overheads, and the risk appetite and the risks that I was willing to take at the time and the types of deals that I was willing to do as a property investor. And I compare that with fast forward towards maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, setting up a bridge lending business, development lending business, where you're able to make double digit returns, but you're only taking, let's say, 70% of the property level risk. You get quite spoiled, I think. And then, of course, that became more difficult to achieve. We got institutional funding and all the rest of it. So again, you've got that conflicts of interest and cherry picking thing that comes along. So then you've got to go back to going back to deploying capital as a property investor in your own right, or I was certainly had to. And where I found I was struggling was that you've been spoiled with these great returns for so long, and then you look at what you have to pay for things and to try and square those circles. Now, ironically, I think that's played out quite nicely for me, particularly the most recent deal that I've done, where I ended up buying off an institution at nearly half of what they paid for it, a double-digit return. I think that will pay quite nicely for me. But then again, the reason I asked the question about, I suppose, trading versus holding is that I bought something very similar about 10 years ago for our family. And I traded it on maybe 18 months later, because it was an office park. It was before PD rights became permanent, and then PD rights became permanent. And then effectively I was able to lock in a 20 or 30% uplift in the value of the property without really doing anything to it. This time around, I'm in a similar position where I've probably bought something just at the bottom of the market. And actually, I could probably sell it for another £1 million or so now. But the difference is now I look back at the two decisions and I think, I wish I'd made, circumstances were such that at the time I had to trade it that time because I needed the cash to go and do other things. Now I don't have the same financial pressures. So I actually want to sit on it and try and ride the income. So I just find it quite interesting just to have that contrast and see the difference in your situations and how you approach things, depending on the position you are in your life.
I think property suffers a little bit from emotion, because we all live in houses which are partially an investment, but primarily an emotional thing. You know as well as I do that when you go and look at a house that you really love, you might well end up overpaying for it because you've fallen in love with it. You shouldn't fall in love with property. If you look at the investment portfolio of any equities fund manager, they will buy and sell shares every 5 minutes because they take a view on the particular share, it's going up, down, or they want to sell it. Whereas a property fund manager tends to be more passive, and I don't think you should be passive with property. Almost every property has cycles, and we're going through cycles at the present moment. Industrial has had a huge upward tick. It's fallen off a bit. It's leveling out. It's probably going to go back up again at the present moment. It's a good time to buy industrial at the present moment. But property does have cycles, and you've got to try and maximize your returns from those cycles. A passive investor in property, in housing, you've probably done very well. But in most forms of commercial property, you know, when I started, bowling alleys were quite popular. A couple of decades later, multiplex cinemas were everybody's cup of tea. These cycles change. David Lloyd tennis centers, everybody was making a lot of money out of. These cycles do change, and you have to ride them, but not get too emotional about owning the property long term.
No, I think that's absolutely right. Where do you stand on pensions investing in these sort of passive UK property funds? Because speaking from my own personal experience, I've bought, I'd say the majority of commercial assets we bought over the last decade and a half as a family, we've bought from UK institutions, UK pension funds, and invariably we've been paying close to half of what that institution had paid for that asset when we bought it off them. Would you say that those specific types of, say, closed-ended funds are good places for investors to be putting their money, or actually should they really be putting them with more active managers like Fiera or what was then Palmer?
I think absolutely the answer you're obviously going to get from me is put it with a more active manager. The passive pension fund managers have not done well, and again, they hang on too long. The more active managers do much better, and the skilled managers like CBRE, LaSalle, the larger ones today are not of that nature. They've all learned to be much more active managers of their portfolios, both direct and indirect. The small pension funds that used to exist many years ago were in some cases ridiculous. I can remember when I was at Lambert Smith and Partners, we used to have one particular client, I won't say who, but it was a cooperative society. And I can remember talking to their pension fund. And I said, you know, what is your spread of property investments? And they said, well, most of our pension fund is actually invested in property. We don't have many other investments. And I said, well, what is your spread of tenants? and most of their fund, in fact, virtually all of it, was invested in themselves and in their own region. So it was virtually all shops in a single region with a single covenant risk. And that was a pension fund. Those sorts of funds no longer exist. That was many decades ago. But it illustrates why small pension funds, you know, even if you're £1 billion or £2 billion pension fund with, say, 5 or 10% in property, that's 100 million. That doesn't really get you an adequate spread these days. It's much better to be in some form of fund where you've got an active manager. Or a number of funds, in reality. You wouldn't want to put it all in one fund.
In fact, our most recent purchase, that was off a, you know, very well-known manager of asset manager across a multitude of assets. And my father-in-law, who's a dentist by training, he said to, by profession, he said to me, why are we able to pick this up so cheaply? And I said, why are they selling it now? And I said, well, one of the issues, and you can tell me whether you agree with this, but I think one of the issues that you have with these big multi-asset managers who also do property is that they might have 100, let's say they have 100 billion of assets under management, of which they have an allocation of, let's say, 10% to property. They've then decided that they want to reduce their allocation to 5% of property, and the property they want to hold is not offices, but they want to own, you know, beds and sheds, let's say. They're not thinking about exacting the best price. They're just looking. They've been told by the CIO that they need to reallocate and liquidate at the best price that they can get in the market at that time, and that doesn't lead to good outcomes for the investors ultimately.
It may not even be reallocation. It may simply be that they have a percentage allocation to property, and the equities have had a good run,
yes,
such that the properties themselves have become too large a percentage in the fund, and therefore, although properties are doing well, they're forced to sell.
So it's even worse than that. When you're looking at a new developer partner, or when you were looking, at least when in the Palmer Capital days, and I imagine you're when you're looking at a new developer partner, what are you looking for? What are the criteria that makes a new development sponsor attractive to you?
Well, we've got a number of criteria. The first one is that we want to invest in people that are at the beginning of their prime. So this essentially means backing people that are ideally in their early 30s, because the prime, really energetic activity of anyone is from, say, 30 to 55. That's the window of when they're at their best. And we want to get them at the beginning of that. So hopefully they've been a successful surveyor or a successful surveyor within a property company or institution, and they've decided they're brave enough to go by themselves. Now, interestingly, we get a lot of people that present a business plan to us and say, you know, set out the business plan and then explain that they'd like a couple of £100,000 a year as a basic salary and so on and so forth. But they'd also like the 2/3 of the shareholding that we standardly offer. Going back to the Rembridge example, we like to keep our shareholding consistent. And the simple answer to that question, this isn't starting up by yourself, this is swapping employer. So anyone that's brave enough to start up by themselves when they're at, say, age 32, when they probably just got married or just had children or perhaps both, this is a brave time to do it. They're carrying a mortgage, young children, or they're about to have young children. This is the worst time to do it financially, but it's a best time to judge their bravery. So that's a very important criteria. Next criteria, we don't really want to tread on our own toes. We've got property companies that are good at various things or various regions, and we don't really want to tread on our own toes. They've got to be really driven. We used to have a joke, which is no longer relevant because we're part of a corporate entity now and we don't do this sort of joke, that once we've done all the due diligence on a prospective property company that we wanted to back, we would send them off for psychiatric tests, and if they passed, we wouldn't invest. The reason for that is that our very best property company investments, the people are so driven that, you know, they, some other parts of their brain are not, you know, really, really good people, are very driven people, and that's worked well for us. I have to say, all our current investments are nice, normal people.
What would you say are the, what would you say the personal characteristics of a really successful developer needs to have, in addition to that, that sort of maniacal determination and drive?
I think it's changed enormously over the years, but the first answer that comes to mind, excuse me, but it's a particularly an answer as far as I'm concerned, is trustworthiness, absolute trust. The property industry doesn't have the greatest reputation in terms of people sticking to their word, but I believe it's incredibly important. I can remember when my son-in-law joined me as chief executive at the beginning of our fundraising career. A number of the property companies that we had investments in, the agreement was actually written on a couple of pages of A4 and initialed. There was no legal document. We hadn't bothered to go to lawyers. And Alex said, look, I can't take this to institutions. We've got to document this properly, which of course we did. But the essence of my answer is that there was a very high level of trust between the people we were backing and ourselves. So trust, I would say, is really, really important. Secondly, flexibility of mind. We talked earlier on about how the property industry changes. It does change, and you have to be flexible and move with the market. Going back to the trust point, in order for one to buy deals, the market as such, which is largely dominated by agents, has to believe that if they're going to bring you a deal, you're going to be a trustworthy person to deal with, and that they can recommend you to the vendor and so on. But in order to have the opportunity of demonstrating your trustworthiness, you have to be a nice and sociable person in the first place. Somebody that is too quiet and not very social isn't going to get deals offered to them because they won't be liked by the agents or they won't know the agents. So you have to be a combination of a nice person and a trustworthy person. That's very important.
So good people only, essentially. In a nutshell,
good people. We used to have a strap line on the bottom of the Palmer Capital paper, which read, "Investing in people, investing in property." In other words, the people came first. It was awful if you got somebody coming to you with a really tempting good deal who didn't really like the people, because you might get tempted buy the deal because it was so good. Fortunately, we never did. But we did in back people that didn't do a deal for 18 months sometimes. If you get the people right, then the business will follow. And with documentation, if you have a good relationship with your partners in a business and something goes wrong, you can sort it out. If you have a bad relationship with people, it becomes a nightmare.
Yeah, I think that's a great bit of advice, in the sense that you're going to have to, you know, as someone who's with Zahair, my co-founder, and Avonmore, we backed a development business called Chartfield, which is still ongoing. And I think the key thing there is that I've known Richard, who runs Chartfield. I've known him for a long time before. He's a nice guy. He's a good guy. He's a good operator. You have to be someone that you're going to have a long-term relationship with them. Chartfield's over 5 years old now. You have to have a good long-term relationship with these people, because they're people that you're going to be spending a lot of time with, and you're going to have a relationship with them for a long time. And it makes a lot of sense that you don't have to spend time a long time. And we're only on this planet for a finite period of time, after all. It's our most precious resource when we really think about it.
It's our time.
Why would you choose to spend your time with people that you won't enjoy dealing with? Exactly. And as you say, you may have things in contracts, but contracts are only good up to some point.
If you need to look at the contract, you're in trouble a lot of the time.
Well, we're currently in the process of having to enforce on an option agreement with Chartfield, and the problem is that if we have to enforce on that contract and we have to go to court, we'll probably end up in a worse position than had the contract been seen through appropriately. And also, we're going to have to deal with the hassle of going through litigation to get there. So the solution is actually having to deal with the individuals on the other side of the table, trying to accommodate what they want to happen, and you probably end up with a better outcome. And that's the thing that I think sometimes people can get too much comfort from contracts, but actually, kind of what you're alluding to is actually being able to pick up the phone and have a sensible conversation with someone is far more important.
I mean, it's super important, and to live with them and know them well enough to be able to read between the lines of what they're saying. You know, I know which of our developers will describe a board inquiry as a pre-let, and which of them will be more cautious. But it's important to be able to understand and read between the lines of what they're saying, and trust what they're saying as well.
Because you like to have such close relationships with the developers that you work with, does that then put a natural ceiling on the number of developers you can work with in terms of backing?
No, I don't think it does. But there is a natural ceiling in terms of geography and sector. We've currently got 9 developers that we back. I think probably the ceiling is about maybe 12 at absolute maximum. But we would very much like to have 1 or 2 more developers at the present moment, but no more than 1 or 2. And, you know, we have had developers in the past where they've done really well and they've decided to retire. And so occasionally one is going to lose one, either because somebody does well and wants to retire, or because there's a corporate sale. So unless you add occasionally to the portfolio, it will inevitably decline.
And that makes sense. That's what I was going to ask. One of the things I wanted to ask was, are there opportunities for exit for the developers that you back? And presumably that will be the case.
We don't impose exits. We want to support the ambitions of the development companies that we back. Therefore, if they want to sell to somebody else, we will support that. If one of them wants to sell their shares, we will support that. I mentioned that Rembridge was the first development company that we backed. We are still a substantial shareholder, still the same shareholder in Rembridge. I'm still chairman of Rembridge. But Rembridge is now run by three people that are very much younger than the original founders. The two original founders, one left some years ago and was bought out. One has recently retired. It's a natural process. And it's important in a successful company to have a succession policy so that we can keep the 30 to 55 year olds producing the business. And we've been lucky enough to do that with Rembridge and one or two other companies where, a succession policy is now in effect.
And in terms of the companies, the types of companies you're looking for at the moment, what would you say the sector and or region that you're most interested to add to the Fiera / Palmer stable?
Well, it's much easier to give you an answer regionally. And we are particularly interested in backing a Manchester-based company. That is the only major region where we don't have a significant corporate investment. So Manchester is number one regional answer. As to sector, we have an investment in packaged living, which is built to rent and all forms of residential. There will be other sectors that we're going to go for a specialist, but I wouldn't be able to identify a particular one at the present moment. We've got pretty good coverage in beds and sheds, which is where a lot of the market is at the time being. We shall see.
One of the areas I started to wake up to is things like energy assets, energy infrastructure. Is that something that you've considered as well, or is that a bit too niche and a bit too tricky to make work?
Many years ago, we, through an indirect investment, we effectively were involved with about 11% of the UK's solar panels. Today, we're not involved in the energy sector, although we're quite actively looking at it. Wind turbines are jolly difficult to maintain.
I speak with some experience owning some wind turbines as a family.
Solar panels are easy. All you need is some sheep and some windoline. But there are other forms of energy that I think are going to be quite important. And things like battery technology and waste to energy. We're not currently involved in any of them, but we have some very active discussions in one of those sectors. I won't say which one at the moment, but we have some very active discussions in one of those sectors.
They can be a bit niche. It is very niche, and as I'm discovering, particularly in the battery sector, the model's a bit different to let's say residential house building, which obviously is something I know a little bit more about. As you start to learn these things,
and one could argue whether it's pure property or not. In many instances, a lot of the investment is not really pure property.
I think particularly with the battery side of things, if you're then going to operate the batteries and you're going to do the charging and the discharging, and I understand that can be quite algorithmic. You're venturing into energy trading rather than pure property. So yeah, it's interesting, but definitely different set of skills and experiences.
We were involved in one of the largest power station constructions in the UK in Kent a few years ago, which was quite interesting. Kent used to have a lot of coal mines many years ago. Then it became very successful in providing paper to the city because there was a lot of forests in Kent, surprisingly enough. And anyway, we were involved in a power station development in Kent, which was one of the most complex deals I've ever been involved with. It extended my knowledge quite considerably.
When you're talking to a when you're talking to a prospective new investee, how important is it that they've got the pipeline? You know, let's assume that they've got the track record, but how important is it they've got the pipeline for you to execute on? Or is actually the concept the most important thing?
The pipeline is not at all important. It can be confusing. It's the people that we're interested in. If the people have been doing well at their present job, in other words, they're not they're working for somebody else rather than they've already started up by themselves. We tend to invest in people that are completely new startups. You know, they're working for another property company or an agent or a combination of the two. So a pipeline is not at all important to us. The nature of the people and the balancing skills. I mean, our ideal investment is a minimum of two people, where you've got a deal origination person and a deal management stroke building person, so that they complement one another.
Yeah, and I would say that makes a lot of sense because you know there are different skill sets. Someone who can execute won't have the same personality traits as someone who can go out and find the deals.
The detail necessary to build anything is completely different to the skill to find a deal.
Out of interest, where would you say you sat in there? But were you more of an originator than the evaluator in that?
Absolutely an originator. Yeah. I'm not a detail person. I'm absolutely an originator.
What would you say the number one thing someone coming to you with the deal to present should not do? What's the biggest mistake you've seen time and again when people have presented deals to you or presented opportunities to you?
It's the same mistake in numerous different forms, either under-researched or over-bullish. The combination, that's actually two, but the combination of those two is dreadful.
Could I summarize that as lack of credibility?
I'm not sure you could, actually.
Okay.
Because somebody that hasn't, you could have a credible person who's a really good deal doer, and has a gut feel that the deal is going to work, but hasn't adequately researched it. Some of our best deal doers are not so hot on the research.
Right.
But that's where the balance of people, the input that Palmer Capital provided, the input that Fiera now provides, I said right at the beginning of this interview that I asked the what happens if this goes wrong, what happens if this goes wrong type questions. We are a very, very active part of the deal making process, and no one person is, or no two people are ever perfect in the way they present things. So under-researching or being over-bullish, those could be considered good traits sometimes.
Well, like you said that, you know, you found yourself way back when in a position where you were too cautious in your own right, and you do sometimes need that yin and yang to balance these things out. Otherwise, if you're too cautious, you'll never do any deals, and if you're too bullish, you'll do all the deals and you'll go bust. When you're looking at investees, presumably if you're looking at them as a startup, they're not in a position to put skin in the game in terms of very much of their own capital. They're obviously putting their own sweat in. Overall, though, how important do you think co-investment by a developer with a third-party source of equity is, and is there a point in which it becomes impractical to expect it from a developer?
As a general rule, all of the property companies that we've backed have not had the ability to put any cash into deals. Normally, they've been a complete startup. And as I've said, normally they're in the prime of their life, in this gap, their early 30s, hopefully, with all the accoutrements of wife, girlfriend, children, houses, mortgage. They're not able to put money in. If they've done a few successful deals and then they don't want to put money into a deal, one would question it severely. But for the first few deals, we don't expect them to put money in at all.
No. Do you think there is a lack of alternative options to the likes of Fiera, as you are now, for developers who are looking to get started and start up? You know, effectively, is there a lack of backing for those sort of young and hungry wannabe developers?
I think there are quite a lot of people, like you described yourself as being willing to back someone. There are quite a lot of people that are prepared to back one or two companies in a one-off form. I don't think there are many, if any, that make it one of the principal strands of their business to back development companies. The formula that we've got of institutional funds on the one hand and venture capital backing of property companies on the other hand, I think is pretty unique. Funnily enough, I think it's actually pretty unique in the world, let alone the UK. We had an approach many years ago from an Australian business that wanted to buy us because they were pursuing that policy, and they'd worked out that we were the only ones in the world doing it in exactly that way. I'm sure there were lots of others that are relatively similar, but the two principal foundations of our business are, in that combination, quite unique.
Certainly, one of the things that I've experienced and witnessed over time is developers get to a certain point. They get the, you know, they get Bob down the golf club to give them £500,000 or £1 million for a deal. Then Bob's checkbook is empty, and then their only other option is to go to the private equity fund who won't get out of bed for less than a £10 or £20 million check. So then they find themselves in that sort of limbo. And there are very few options for these developers. So what advice would you give to developers who are in that, what I would call, scale up phase, when they need to go beyond Bob from the golf club and not quite at a scale where they can work with, you know, your Blackstones and
I think the simple answer to that come and talk to Fiera.
Okay, well, that sounds like a pretty good option in that case. Where do you see the next 18 months going in terms of the UK property market, both commercial and residential? Do you see green shoots, or are you still got the sort of the amber lights on?
That's as you know, that's quite a difficult question. We've had a pretty major correction 12 months or so ago, when commercial property values dropped by 20%, something like that. We've also got elections in the UK coming up towards the end of this year, I guess. We've got elections in about a third of the world coming up in the same time frame. I can't recall in my life when so much of the world has been electing as is happening in 24. And I don't think I've ever seen an election that hasn't caused a pre-election and post-election pause, even though the result of the election looks like a foregone conclusion. I think it's still inevitable that we will have a little bit of a pause for a few months over the election from the date it's announced to sometime after. So that's a 3 or 4 month period in 2024 when the market's going to pause, in my view. We've also got global conditions which are, I'm much older than you, but the global conditions we've got at the moment are as bad as we've seen for a very long time. The Middle East, Ukraine, Russia, it's awful at the moment. And we are taking a view that those conditions are relatively benign. I think we still need to be quite cautious. So there are, I think, good opportunities to buy in the present market. We've bought recently a number of industrial sites where we've paid half what they might have sold for 12 months or so ago. I do think the industrial demand is still there, although it's changing. The demand for very big boxes is no longer anywhere near as good as it was. We still have a growing population, people still need roofs over their head. Planning policy, every year that I've been in business, planning has become slower and slower and slower. So that causes the inflation that we've had in housing. So residential is still a good investment, but even those two sectors, I think you need to be cautious of. Offices. The UK has gone back to work in offices more than America, for instance. I was in New York a few weeks ago, and the occupancy of offices there is much less than in the UK. Will offices go the way of retail? I don't think so, but offices need to be a very great deal better than they used to be. The refurbished 1970s building doesn't cut it anymore. So, yes, there is a market, but you need to be very, very cautious.
Ray, we were just remarking on the start of your career, and that you're one actually of coming up to a dozen people that we've had interviewed, very accomplished, very successful, who left school at 16, worked in an estate agency and started out in an estate agency and then have gone on to really successful careers. So we thought that was that was actually quite a really fascinating and interesting trend, that how many people end up following that path and end up doing really well out of it.
I think that's probably an age thing. It was relatively normal, whereas today, where the parents themselves are more affluent rather than the poverty of people coming out of World War II, most people go to university. Most people that got any brain at all go to university. So I think it's possibly an age thing. But there are... I've met somebody recently who's decided not to go to university and has started up his own business. He's not in property. And he will either be super successful or go bust. But he has a real entrepreneurial drive such that he didn't want to waste time at university.
I don't think that's a bad idea anyway. I think university is becoming increasingly, especially with the rise of AI and the amount of information available to you, how useful university is.
The two best employees I had at Lambert Smith and Partners, when I had many more employees than I've got here, one was Tony Gibbon. And one was a guy called Nick Barham. Who's less high profile than Tony, but actually much more successful than Tony. Neither of them went to university. Neither of them are charter surveyors, though they've both been incredibly successful.
So just following on from the last question, we were talking about change of government, and as someone who's actively involved in the planning system and probably would have a fuller hairline if I wasn't, do you think the change of government will be good for property more generally, and also from the planning, particularly from the planning perspective, obviously given how active a number of your investees are in the planning system as well?
Well, it's two questions. First of all, will it be good for property generally? I think government stability will be good for property generally. We haven't had stability since the trust debacle. And stability will be very good for property generally. The thing that I worry about is too great a Labour majority. With too big a majority, the left wing might come back into play a bit more, and that could be really negative for property. But assuming that we continue to have a Blair-style Labour government, which I think is likely, although perhaps the Labour Party wouldn't appreciate me calling it a Blair-style Labour government, I think that'll be good for property, providing that we have stability and providing that the left wing of the Labour Party don't cause unrest. And that would be in the property world and the business world as a whole. The second question, planning. I wish government would leave planning alone and simplify it. Every time they try and make it better, they end up making it longer and worse and more complicated, with another report required for this, that, and the other. I mean, the planning system is terrible. Also, the planning system is the narrow point of a funnel. A huge amount of economic activity relies on development, people's new headquarters, warehouses, factories, office buildings, whatever. Yet, planning departments are understaffed and understaffed by poorly paid people, such that the quality of people that one is dealing with is generally poor. We need much better paid planners with much less regulation.
I would echo their sentiments in their entirety. Yes, I mean, especially as being on the wrong end in the last fortnight of a planning refusal, which didn't need to be a refusal, could have been a phone call or a meeting with the planning officer. The planning officer, from what I was told by our advisor, they'd rather not spend any more time on the case and then just kick it on to the planning inspector. Not because, for no reason other than they just don't want to dedicate any more resource to it because they're so under-resourced. So they just effectively rob Peter to pay Paul and pass the buck to the planning inspector.
It's a pinch point in the process, and it's terrible at the moment. It needs hugely simplified. And as I said, we need better quality of people dealing with it.
Do you think, as far as in terms of the planning system, whilst Labour do seem to be talking a good game about housing and maybe, you know, sort of the sacred cow of the green belt may come under threat in the sort of the Labour Lord giveth, but will the Labour Lord taketh away with their ambitions around environmental aspirations, where all these additional new regulations have come into play that we've seen under the Tories? Will that just continue and potentially get worse?
I think it'll be quite difficult for the Labour government to be brave enough to provide the deregulation that is necessary. I think it's unlikely.
Let's hope that on that you're wrong, but we shall see. I have a feeling your experience is quite telling. If we could just change tack a little bit. Obviously, you're very experienced in your career. Recently, or a few years ago, made the decision to sell out Palmer Capital to Fiera. What was the motivation there? What was the driver there? Presumably, by that point, you would have had other partners in Palmer, or was it exclusively your decision to transact?
Palmer Capital, at the stage where we sold, was myself and my family still owning about 85% of the business. A number of executives here had acquired a shareholding, which turned out to be quite valuable for them. But the principal decision was that we had reached possibly what you might describe as a glass ceiling. We were a very active niche business. We have some very good quality people here, and in order for them to progress, they needed to be able to play on a larger stage. And we had a number of approaches from different people. The business that we ended up really liking was Fiera, and we felt that we would be very comfortable with them and very trusting of them, going back to the word that I used several times in this interview. And that has proved to be the case. We also felt that we would have the advantages of a bigger business, but they would leave us alone to carry on the ethos of the business that we'd established. And that has worked well as well. On top of that, of course, I'm 76, and it was nice to pass go and cash in some chips.
I have to say, you look incredibly well for 76, Ray, so you're doing something right. You're obviously a very energetic and young 76. What does the near term future hold for you? What are your future plans personally?
I'm getting married in the middle of June, so that's exciting.
Congratulations on that.
Third time lucky. It's a lady that I've known for 40 years. She used to run the premier headhunting agency in the property world, and I used her quite a lot at Lambert Smith Hampton, and have known her ever since. So that's exciting. We are developing the estate that we have in Wiltshire, which is fun. We have, I'm a very keen fly fisherman. And we have half mile of the one of the country's major chalk streams running through the grounds. I'm also a very keen gardener. We've got 7 acres of formal gardens and 2 full-time gardeners, but we do a lot of gardening ourselves. And we enjoy the countryside and the animals and so forth. When I asked Patricia what she wanted for Christmas this year, I was expecting a frock or jewellery or something like that. She asked for a couple of goats, which I thought was going to be a cheap deal. But £7,000 worth of fencing and stabling later, I realised that the goats were the cheap bit of the equation.
And as far as your professional role within Fiera, do you expect that to continue as it has been for the last few years since the sale?
Yes, I do. I was talking with somebody here this morning about what I do, and I work less than half time now, But I'm still chairman of all of the property companies that we're invested in. I'm still chairman of the business. And actually, I find it a really nice balance. Because of my age, I've got, you know, most of my friends are plus or minus the same age as myself. And about half of them have got non-executive positions or are still involved in running their own businesses to some degree. And about half of them are fully retired. If you were to pitch the fully retired half against the still working half in a pub quiz, the fully retired half wouldn't have a hope in hell. The brain is like every other muscle. You have to keep exercising it. And I still enjoy coming here, but I also enjoy not coming here on the days that I don't.
You look at someone like a Warren Buffett as a bit of an idol. Then in that sense that you see he's still doing his thing well into his 90s. Would that be on the cards for you as well?
I don't envisage stopping at this stage, but there must have come a time when you do stop. Warren Buffett being wonderfully successful, but he does seem to have a rather boring life. whereas I travel a lot with Patricia, I fish a lot, I do a lot of different things. And so I proactively enjoy my life rather than... I'm not sure Warren Buffett does so much.
Well, I think he still has. I think he was famous for living a very simple life, wasn't he? Or isn't he? Still is. Yeah. Do you think, you know, you've obviously talked about, you know, having a very nice balance now. Presumably, when you were much younger, it wasn't as much balance in your life, or was that something you actually did actively try and maintain so that you
know, no, I've been. I worked, like most people, far too hard when I was younger. And benefit of hindsight, maybe I would have worked a little bit less. But conversely, I wouldn't be able to be enjoying myself so much as I am now if I hadn't worked so hard. It's plus or minus.
Swings and roundabouts, isn't it? You've mentioned some big names earlier. I mean, for example, you brought up Elliot Bernard, for example. Presumably, along the way, you'll have had some very influential figures and people leave an imprint and leave a mark on yourself. Are there any significant mentors or important figures that you'd like to acknowledge today? You know, people that our listeners might find interesting, or anecdotes that our listeners might find interesting.
I think funnily enough, it's the other way round.
Okay.
The people that run the property companies that we've backed have inspired me. They've, as I said, they rejuvenated me. They've encouraged me to be more bullish than I would otherwise have been. I have huge respect for the younger generation. When we first started to recruit an internal IT person, we were looking at people with CVs of, they were 30 years old. I said, we don't need a 30-year-old, we need a 15-year-old. Generally, I look for inspiration to the younger people that have been fortunate enough to become involved with. They've inspired me.
Yeah, that's great. And I have to say, from my own personal experience, I've taken a lot from that as well, in the sense that I have a number of mentees through Reading Real Estate Foundation, and also just people who I provide kind of informal mentorship to. And my experience, people ask me, you know, what do you do it for? What do you get from it? And I'm always happy to do it because their the energy and the drive and the passion that they have, it rubs off on you, and it's very invigorating. So I can really connect with and resonate with what you're saying in that regard.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important. It's also very important to encourage and nurture and allow those people to blossom and allow them to take the credit for what is being achieved rather than wanting always to be in the limelight.
And final question from me. It's the question that we ask every week, which is advice to your younger self. I mean, if you were to give yourself some self-talk, you can choose the age you would be, but let's say when you were 16 and leaving school as one example, what would you say to your younger self and why?
There's a very easy answer to that. I stayed an agent for far too long. I'm a much better principal than I am an agent. And with the benefit of hindsight, I wish I had become a principal much earlier in my career rather than, I was a principal in an advisory business. But I should have become a principal in a capital business rather than an advisory business much earlier.
As a follow-up question to that, and having started my career in commercial agency 20 years ago, knowing and being friends with a number of agents, still dealing with a number of agents, do you think that's a general theme that people remain agents, commercial agents, for too long, and a lot more of them should have moved over to principal side sooner?
No, I don't actually. When I was an agent, I thought I was an incredibly important and integral part of the property industry. Since I became a principal, I realized how little the role was that an agent actually played. They introduce the site, they introduce the tenant, they do the sale. But there's so much work in between, and agents don't appreciate that. And there are some really good people who make incredibly good agents. They don't necessarily make incredibly good principals, whether as developers or investors. The right stage to move from being an agent to being a principal, that depends on the person. It could be when you're 23, it could be when you're 53. There's not a one answer fits all to that one.
It's great advice. And Ray, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really fascinating, real honor and privilege to spend the time with you. Being respectful of your less active status on a day-to-day basis, but if someone would like to reach out to you and get in touch, is there a preferred way that someone might be able to get in touch with you?
Just ring me or email. I mean, I'm one of those people that will always return a telephone call, worst case, same day, but normally much quicker than that. Same answer with an email or a text or whatever. I don't approve of people that spend 3 days to answer a phone call.
Ray's details will be available via the Fiera website, so we'll spare you from being spammed by everyone on the internet by announcing it here. All that leads me to say is, Ray Palmer, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to our audience, to our viewers and our listeners. Thank you again for your support, and look forward to speaking to you again on the next one.